Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll spend some time talking about earthquakes and earthquake preparedness. Now, while it's true that the central part of the United States is not generally thought of as a place where earthquakes are common, it is true that our region has produced some of the most major seismic events in American history. There were some major quakes here in our part of the country that took place, well, say, in the early 1800s. At a time when the population here was not terribly high, there wasn't a lot of infrastructure to be concerned about. But now there is, and scientists have estimated that there is a very high probability of a major earthquake occurring here in our region within the next few decades, say within the next 50 years. And for that reason, a lot of people here in the state of Illinois, as well as surrounding states, would argue that we ought to be thinking about this and that we ought to be preparing to deal with such a thing in the event that it would occur. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Amir El-Nashai. He's director of the Mid-America Earthquake Center here at the University of Illinois, where he is professor of civil engineering. And we'll talk at least in part about a report that he and a number of other people were involved in putting together for FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, a report looking at the impact of earthquakes on the central USA. This was just made public last month. And if you go to their website of the Earthquake Center, Mid-America Earthquake Center here at the U of I, you can read the report if you like. And also questions are certainly welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana and you'd like to call in with a question, the number is 333-9455. And we do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you are certainly welcome to call. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest before coming here to the University of Illinois. He was a professor of earthquake engineering and head of section at Imperial College at University of London in the UK. He's also been visiting professor at University of Surrey, at University of Tokyo, at University of Southern California, and also the European School for Advanced Studies in Reduction of Seismic Risk in Italy. He's founder, co-editor of the Journal of Earthquake Engineering and is a fellow of the American Society of Civil Engineers and the Institution of Structural Engineers in the UK. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
I appreciate it. Maybe we might just talk for a moment about the study and how it came to be. This was a major undertaking, took a couple of years, and represents the combined efforts of a number of people.
Yes, indeed. We were contacted. Actually, it was on the initiative of FEMA that they actually came to us and said that they are starting what they refer to as a catastrophic planning project. And the two major events that they were looking at are a New Madrid earthquake and a hurricane in Miami. And that they really have no capacity and no personnel, but they have funding. And they would like us to take over the project and execute a scope. And we discussed the scope for about maybe 2 months or so, and eventually the project was launched with full support from FEMA. We had partners, and we still have partners with CUSEC, which is the Central U.S. Earthquake Consortium, a company called Innovative Emergency Management, IEM, and George Washington University at the time had the Center for Crisis, Disaster, and Risk Management. And the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers are also partners. The lead technical group is at the University of Illinois ourselves, the Mid-America Earthquake Center. Mm.
So here the report looks at the possibility of seismic activity in a couple of areas, concentrating mainly, though, on the New Madrid seismic zone.
That's right. There are two areas that would affect two seismic sources, if you like, that would affect Illinois and Indiana. The New Madrid is the major one. It is made up of three segments. And as you pointed out earlier, in 1811, 1812, in the winter of 1811, 1812, there were three major earthquakes. Most people agree that from the evidence that we have, we had no measurements, of course, but we have very detailed reports from people and from newspapers and even pictures. These seem to be three of the largest, if not the largest, earthquakes ever felt in the contiguous U.S. Mm-hmm. So that changes the picture a bit. People think of the mid-continent as being totally stable and has no earthquakes. It has major earthquakes, and these are totally confirmed, and they had some really apocalyptic effects. At the time, as you again pointed out, there were practically no residents. But there were major features of these earthquakes in terms of the reversal of the flow of the Mississippi for a few days, the creation of a lake, which still exists until today. The Real Foot Lake was created because of the earthquake. Major depressions in the ground, some people say up to 20 feet, and many, many areas where the soil, the sand ejected through the mud, if you like, and created something that we refer to as sandful volcanoes due to the liquefaction of the soil. Mm-hmm. So this is the major source. But we also looked at a minor source, if you like, or a less major source, which is the Wabash Valley seismic zone. We had a reminder of the activity of this area on the 18th of April of this year. And most people have felt it very strongly. Some people slept through it. I was one of the lucky ones who woke up and took phone calls and emails from our dean of engineering and things like that.
Yeah. So we need to be reminded of the fact that, as you say, there were major quakes in the New Madrid Fault Zone that took place here now. And it's been more than 100 years. I suppose that enters into your equation. And if you're trying to ask this question, what is the likelihood that we'll have another major quake and when? The longer the time period, as you're looking back to whenever the last one was, does that figure into, I would think that it would have to figure in statistically as you're trying to calculate your likelihood of a future major quake. The longer time that goes since the last one, then your probability must inch up bit by bit as every year goes by.
Sure, you are absolutely right. Let us talk a little bit about this. Maybe 10, 12 years ago, estimates of the return period, meaning the period between large earthquakes on the New Madrid Fault, used to be 500 years. Then there was some research within the May Center. One of our core institutions is the University of Memphis, CERI, Center for Earthquake Research and Information. And their researchers happened to dig trenches in the greater Memphis area, and they found evidence of previous liquefaction. Liquefaction meaning this loss of strength of the soil completely. So the sand turns from sort of a solid with some humidity or some fluid in it, it turns into a fluid, and hence structures sink into the ground. This has been seen in many places, including last year in Niigata in Japan, for instance, where buildings just sunk into the ground intact. They were not damaged by the shaking. They were just lost the strength. So this liquefaction thing is a big thing, especially for us in the Mississippi embayment. Soft deposits are very likely to liquefy if there is a major earthquake. So we go back. They found this evidence of liquefaction at some depth from the surface. So they used various methods of carbon dating and so on, and they came up with a return period of 300 years. This liquefaction happened roughly 300 years before the 1811-1812 earthquakes. So the previous 500 years was based on seismological evidence, if you like. The new period, return period of 300 years, is based on this liquefaction feature. But these are all statistics, and we know how things work. Saying statistically we have whatever percentage occurrence per year doesn't mean that it will not happen now or next year or or in 200 years' time. And estimates are affected by the fact that there hasn't been a large earthquake. So the longer we wait, the more likely the big one would be coming. And that's the same thing everywhere, really. But prediction so precisely is impossible. Not just here, but everywhere, including California, where they have been waiting for a big one for 20 years or so. The best way forward for us is really protection and preparedness as opposed to prediction.
Well, you know, having said that, and I certainly take your point that we could have a major quake. We could have one tomorrow. We could have one in a month from now. We could have one 5 years or 10 years, you know, it could occur at any point there. Though, then how do you, though, go about trying to answer a question? Suppose I say, well, what would you say would be the probability of a major earthquake occurring, let us say, within the next half century, within the next 50 years?
Most scientists, or maybe all scientists but one, think that the probability of having a major earthquake in the coming 50 years is extremely high. So that's sufficient. I mean, numbers can be manipulated in many ways, and everybody knows that statistics are sort of in the eyes of the beholder almost. But the probabilities of having a major earthquake in the coming 50 years are really very high.
Yeah, so I suppose that for that reason, and also for the reason that disaster preparedness, there are a number of natural disasters that could happen. So I suppose that would say, for a variety of reasons, you just say we ought to be prepared, and we shouldn't be just saying, well, we're really not really sure when it's going to happen, or it could not happen in the next 50 years. Maybe one should go on the assumption that the probability is high, so one should be prepared, and you really should start now. And as you said just before we got talking, that it's this kind of thing where you got to lay out a plan. You're going to decide this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to approach it, and work on that over a period of time.
Yes, I agree with you. And the very important point you just touched upon is the synergies, if you like, between the preparedness for different natural and man-made disasters. Mm-hmm. This is not as if you will prepare for an earthquake independently of preparing for a hurricane or a malicious act of explosion or a flood. There are very strong interdependencies between these, and being prepared across the board would be the wise thing to do, obviously.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Amir Elnashai, is professor of civil engineering at the University of Illinois. He is also director of the Mid-America Earthquake Center here at the U of I. And we're talking about the potential for a major earthquake here in our area sometime over the next few decades. He and many other people were involved in a report that was done for FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, that was released in November, on November 20th. And they worked on this for a couple of years, looking at what would be the potential impact of a major earthquake on those states that are in the New Madrid seismic zone, and certainly Illinois is one of them. We're also talking about Illinois, Indiana, Tennessee, Kentucky, Missouri. Is Arkansas would be a part of that. So,
Alabama.
And of course, it would depend on the extent of damage would depend on where the quake was centered, and also what you tried to do is look at the possibility of the strongest point of the quake could be in different places. So depending upon where it is, the damage is going to be different. You know, it's going to affect differently those parts of those different states. But it would seem, though, that one state, virtually no matter where the epicenter, if that's the correct kind of language to use, where the strongest part is concentrated, it seems that one state is really under the gun no matter what, and that's the state of Tennessee.
Yes, we estimate that Tennessee would be hardest hit. I think Arkansas is very, very strongly influenced by any of the New Madrid scenarios also. Mm-hmm. There are two things that I wanted to add or clarify regarding your statement. One, what's this definition of the epicenter? The epicenter is where the fracture in the ground starts, but then it propagates. And as it propagates, it emits energy that actually shakes the ground and damage facilities and so on. The fault length should be seen as series of epicenters, the entire fault, because they will all emit equal amounts of energy, roughly. Mm-hmm. Where the fracture started is not very significant. And earthquakes with such magnitude would have a very substantial fault length. Just to give you a feel for it, for instance, the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco, it was 8.1, and the fault length was in excess of 250 kilometers. So you can imagine sort of an epicenter with a length of 250 kilometers. Wherever you are close to any point on the 250 kilometers rupture, you will feel the full blast of the underground explosion, if you like. Mm. So the area affected by the New Madrid activity is actually quite substantial, regardless of where the fracture starts. In terms of what states would be most affected, the interesting aspect of, from a, an emergency response point of view, and that is recognized in FEMA, is that it has to be a multi-state effort, both in mitigation right now and preparedness and in response. You will get something like perhaps 250,000 people displaced from one state. Where will they go? Say people in southern Illinois, I think the estimates in our report, if my memory serves me right, is about 50,000 people displaced in Illinois. Where will they go? You cannot control where people head to. So other neighboring states have to have a plan of accommodating whoever comes across their borders.
Yeah.
It could be that Illinois residents move northwards, or they might move to Indiana. The Tennessee people will be all over the place, because it is hard to imagine that the state would have a capacity of accommodating 250,000 people, homeless, without not just neighboring states helping them, but actually federal government helping.
Yeah. And this certainly, when you take a look at the numbers here, they are sobering when you consider how much damage could be done. So we're talking about economic losses running in the tens of billions of dollars. And then this immediate issue that you're going to have people that are not going to have shelter. And we, as you say, we're talking about, in some cases, could be a couple of 100,000 people who are going to need some place to stay. And of course, then they'll have their needs will have to be taken care of. We'll have to have food for them, and some of them are going to need medical care. And that's going to be an extremely serious issue.
Yes, I think the FEMA leadership, after reviewing the report, they have concluded that this would be by far the worst natural disaster in the history of the U.S. As somewhat shocking the report is, actually the report is probably better than what will happen in reality. What will happen in reality would be worse. And that is what we're doing in the phase two of the study. I'll give you one simple example. Mm-hmm. We have not looked at the functionality, if you like, of the transportation system. We have reported damage, direct damage to bridges, but we did not look at what this damage will do to the transportation system. Now we are doing detailed transportation network modeling to see what areas will not be accessible. If the transportation system goes down in various areas that are critical to the rescue effort, then rescue operations will be very severely hampered. Bringing in supplies to support the communities that will be displaced would be sometimes impossible. Evacuating people sometimes would be impossible. So I hate to be really the agent of doom and gloom, but the situation looks even more gloomy than this report reports. And I think that our phase two report, which will be due early summer of next year, will worry people even more than this one.
Yeah. Well, that's and I think it's certainly important that people consider that and think about infrastructure issues. And you can be certain that utility services going to be disrupted. We're going to have water lines broken. We may have power lines down. Natural gas lines are going to be broken. And I seem to recall that in thinking back to the great earthquake in San Francisco, that while the initial damage of the shaking was really bad, what was even worse was fires that resulted from gas lines being ruptured. The more I think about it, the more frightening the idea becomes.
Yes, I have also an important comment in this respect, and maybe an appeal to private industry in the region. You touched upon utility networks. We are reporting utility network damage in our phase one report, but actually we do not have the pipeline data for any of the systems. We are faking. We are pretending that with every street there will be a utility pipeline, and this is not the case. Why are we doing this? Because the utility network information is owned by private industry. Our attempts at getting this data before the phase one study started have failed. We met with several utility operators, and they totally refused to help with where are their pipelines, what diameters are they, and what materials are they, because that's really their sort of competitive edge, if you like, and there are competitors that would utilize this information to go to customers where they are thin on the ground or where they are vulnerable to earthquakes and say, you know, we have a better network. So we have this, if you like, proxy data that we pretend is the utility network data. Since then, we have actually been contracted by two utility network operators in two major cities, which I'd rather not mention. People can guess. They are the two main cities that would be affected by a New Madrid earthquake. And since then, we got the data for their network. Nevertheless, they insisted on us signing a non-disclosure agreement so that we cannot use the results in the FEMA study. So here we are, the same people, the same team are running detailed analysis of the utility networks in these two major cities, and we know pipe by pipe what is likely to happen, and we are still faking in the FEMA study by pretending that the utility network is really the road network. We are trying to work with them to convince them that they totally reject the idea of having maps with their network and showing where the weaknesses are. But we are trying to sort of compromise in terms of perhaps reporting shaded areas in different colors. Say maybe dark red is really this would be totally without service, and lighter colors would be milder leaks, and green would be fine, without showing pipe by pipe, but showing zones of shading in different colors. And they are thinking of that, and they haven't agreed yet. So this is something that where central government does not really have jurisdiction over private industry, even when it comes to the general good, and the national response plan really depends on these numbers that we are issuing. Right now, we as your report has shown, mm-hmm. we have worked on the county level for the 8 states. Right now, the phase 2 is actually FEMA regions. There are 4 FEMA regions in the central U.S., and we are doing now analysis for each region. Region might be 1 state or 2 or 3. And then next year, we'll start running the national exercise for FEMA federal, if you like, to then inject this information into the national response plan.
We're at midpoint here. We have a caller. We'd certainly welcome others. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here who's been patient, and we'll get right to them on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, very interesting topic. I've sort of been fascinated by this. Personally, I was about 11 miles from Kobe when the earthquake occurred back in early 95, and it was quite devastating, I must say, even where I was. And I think it was only maybe a 6 on the Richter scale. I'm curious, let's say that there's a 6, something like a 6 in Champaign, in the Champaign area. At the individual level of homes, are, for example, brick dwellings generally safe in the event of a 6 earthquake, as according to the American Building, or I should say the Illinois, I guess, building codes? Or if you, for example, compared, obviously it's apples and oranges in many ways, a Japanese case, but the American Building Codes, how prepared are we for a major earthquake, leaving aside, of course, emergency services and water, lines and so forth being shut down, and fire and so forth. I'm just curious.
Okay. You have multiple questions.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Just say just a brief word on Kobe. Kobe was 6.7 to 6.9. It's not
right.
Just the magnitude. It's actually at least 2 other factors that play into the damage, which is how close it was,
right.
And also what is the soil condition on which the facilities are built.
Uh-huh.
Kobe was devastating because the breakage happened and progressed towards Kobe. So there was sort of a focusing effect of the fault breaking on Awaji Island and then
right.
Propagating towards Kobe. So it's sending one signal after the other, and the later signal catches up with the earlier signal and becomes really very, very intense. Are we prepared for a magnitude 6, and whether masonry or brick houses would survive or not? It depends on how close the magnitude 6 is and what is the soil condition of under the building. So, for instance, for brick buildings, if they are on softer ground, they will be better off if the soil does not liquefy. So if the soil holds on and doesn't break and doesn't liquefy, then the softer site is better for masonry than the harder site. If masonry is built on rock and the earthquake is close, then it will be shattered. And these are the complications that sometimes elude the authorities. They think that a certain type is sort of a certain type of structure is better than another. It really depends on how much is excited and what is the shape of the signal that excites it. So it really depends on three things we should always remember to link together: magnitude, distance, and soil condition. So for example, a major earthquake on the New Madrid Fault will be felt in Chicago in terms of very large displacements of high-rise buildings.
Oh.
The low-rise buildings will feel possibly nothing, and maybe even the people on the ground will not feel anything because there will be very long vibrations, very long period vibrations, moving from one side to another at such a slow speed that people will not notice. But the high-rise buildings themselves, they have a long vibration period. So there's some sort of a resonance between the high-rise buildings and the very large, very distant earthquake. And that is something that people don't take into account. In
yep.
terms of preparedness, you have implied that the emergency services are prepared and others you are asking about. Unfortunately, the emergency services are not prepared either.
Oh, okay.
The level of damage to fire stations, police stations, hospitals, utilities, water, gas, and electricity because of a New Madrid earthquake are really very disheartening. So we are not prepared, in short.
I think one thing also that most people don't realize, unless you've been in a major earthquake, that the aftershocks are just devastating. Obviously there were 1,600 aftershocks within a few days, but in terms of feeling them, and at the level of 4 to 5 on the Richter scale, every 15 minutes for 3 days, this is, you can't even sleep, right? That's the level. Yeah. I mean, my estimate was that we were probably at a 6 where I was, 11 miles away. I mean, that's just a guess. I mean, I have no idea, but it was cracked the walls and TV fell on the floor and books were flying at us and so it, and I was in bed, but so it was kind of surprising to say the least, but it just continues and one wonders whether the house will fall. It was shaken off its, foundation and so forth at the time. And we eventually moved out, of course, but I think people should, when they're preparing for these things, keep in mind that it's not the beginning. It's only a beginning, I should say, once you have the initial shock that you can have these continued shocks and certainly will have continued shocks if it's anything major.
You are right, and even the situation, the New Madrid Fault is a little bit worse or maybe significantly worse, that the 1811, 1812 earthquakes were three. They were of roughly equal magnitude and they were a few weeks apart. So they are not even, they were not just subjected to the normal aftershock activity. Usually we say that aftershocks are one magnitude scale lower than the main shock.
Right.
But after the aftershocks started dying down, there was a major earthquake. And then aftershocks, and then a third major earthquake. And these are linked to one another through three fault segments, but they are slipping independently. So there are three major earthquakes with their aftershocks, and this is what we expect to happen in the future as well.
Yeah, in the case of the Kobe thing, that just where I was, we were a week without water, there was no phone service for at least a week. And that's, in Japan, I think, was probably far more prepared in some ways on that level than America. So just to give people a sense. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Amir El-Nashai. He is professor of civil engineering at the University of Illinois and is also director of the Mid-America Earthquake Center. He and his colleagues at the center and a lot of other folks were involved in looking at the impact of earthquakes on the central U.S. This was a study that they did for FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, was released last month. And if you're interested in taking a look at it, you can go to their website. That is, go to the website of the Mid-America Earthquake Center at the U of I, and you can read the study. Questions here are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. The study concludes that there would be, if there was a major quake on the New Madrid Fault, there would be very, very significant structural damage in a number of states. Probably faring the worst would be Tennessee. After that would be Missouri, but also Kentucky would be affected, Illinois affected, a lot of places. What can you just talk a little bit more about what sort of structural damage you would think that it would be likely that would be seen?
We categorize structural damage in, well, we have to categorize damage to buildings in three subclasses, if you like. One is due to shaking, just having cracks and things falling and direct damage because the structure is being moved violently from one side to another. The other is loss of support, that the soil itself fails. And that will happen for sure in the Mississippi embayment. For example, last year we worked on the Peru earthquake in South America, and we visited for about 7 or 8 days. And there was a whole street of buildings that sunk roughly 3 feet to 4 feet into the ground. They were not so much damaged by shaking because the loss of coherence in the soil acts almost like an isolator. It does not transmit the shaking. But then because the soil has lost its strength, the structure has lost its support. And they sink, and you find that houses were just sort of halfway through a whole story, and the rest is underground. So damage from direct shaking would include structural damage of, you know, beams and columns cracking and maybe structures completely collapsing where they are. And damage to the soil will mean heavy structures will tilt or sink. So you lose their utility anyway. The third subclass, if you like, is non-structural damage. And that is usually very influential in determining the level of injury. When you have non-structural damage, meaning the things that are inside the structure that are not really carrying load, like partition walls between rooms, like false ceilings, like cooling and heating equipment, like televisions, like heavy computers, control panels in factories and things like these will also move and fall, and they usually cause injuries. They are also very influential in terms of the economic loss, because some equipment in factories are extremely expensive, and such failure of non-structural components would put a factory out of action, and then they lose their market share, and their customers find other sources of the same product and so on.
I have a number of callers here. I promise these folks I get right to them. But just to ask one further question, have you talk for a moment or two. Is it possible to retrofit existing structures? Is there anything that can be done with an existing building to try to make it better withstand such an event? Can you do anything about it?
Absolutely. Of course, retrofitting is usually more expensive than improving the design of new structures. But we have to appreciate that even if we start today to design to resist earthquakes in the central U.S., the influence that we'll have on the general population would be minimal. Maybe we'll have an influence in 20 to 50 years. So we absolutely have to start retrofitting. And there are many, many tried and tested ways of improving the performance of structures in earthquakes. They have been tried all over the world, including in the U.S., in California, and they work very well. Some of them are more disruptive than others to the use of the facility. Usually, there is a sort of reverse relationship. The more disruptive are less costly, and the less disruptive are more costly. For example, you have a building, and it really has to continue to be used by this big company. It's the headquarters of a company, and they are not willing to evacuate. You have to do something external, perhaps build buttresses outside, and then link these buttresses with the structure and make it resist earthquakes. There are means of isolating structures, meaning that it is actually done, that you put the structures on hydraulic jacks, and then you cut the columns, and then you cast new foundations, and then you put isolation material between the new and old foundations. And then you release the structure from the jacking up, and here you are, you have a structure that has been isolated. It will move as a rigid body. It will not shake, and hence it will not be damaged. Especially if there are no structures nearby, it doesn't matter how much it moves as long as it comes back to where it was. So there are endless ways of strengthening structures and protecting life. It is a matter of really political will and economic constraints.
We have a number of people here. We'll try to talk with them all in the time that's left in this part of the show, starting in with someone in Champaign and line number two. Hello?
Yeah, hello?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes.
Could we get secondary disasters from flooding along the Mississippi and Illinois River by any of those locks and dams or levees failing, or is that not likely?
It is unfortunately very likely. In terms of the levees, if we are sufficiently unlucky to have damage to levees from the shaking during some sort of a spring situation where the water level is high and it's a rainy season or a rainy period, then we can have significant flooding. Analysis of dams is a very significant parameter of what is happening in phase two. Phase one didn't look at dams because of the limited time and opportunities that we have. But right now we are indeed looking at dams. We have collected the digital elevation maps of the central U.S. and then we analyze the dams outside of our general simulation software, estimate whether they will really leak or break completely. We know the volume of water behind them, and we know where they are situated and how would they leak, and hence one can draw a flooding map quite easily after an earthquake scenario, and this we will be reporting in phase two.
And that would be without any warning, obviously.
Unfortunately, as FEMA taught us, this is called a no-notice event, as opposed to a hurricane, which they consider to be a sort of a long-notice event.
Well, I hope there's a political authority to look after those coordination of multi-state areas, like this, whether your authority hasn't would. I don't think would your group would have anything more than suggestions as opposed to legislative power to coordinate.
We have no more power than just issuing the signs. But reassuringly, yesterday I got a call from a lady who is the secretary of the chairman of the House of Representatives Committee on Science and Technology. And she said that he asked her to call the May Center and to get sort of a face-to-face reality report. Is this real? Have we faked anything? Is it really very important? Is it as bad as we report and so on? We had a very good talk for maybe 20, 25 minutes, and she said that she is summarizing everything we discussed, and she will present it to him, and he's the chair of the Science and Technology Committee in the House. So we seem to be getting somewhere.
That make New Orleans a few years back look like a picnic in comparison.
I agree, and unfortunately it would look really ugly, and especially now that such a report exists in the public domain, there is really no excuse not to do anything about it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. About 10 minutes left here. Let me just quickly again introduce our guest, Dr. Amir El-Nashai. He's professor of civil engineering and also director of the Mid-America Earthquake Center here at the University of Illinois. And the report that we've mentioned, again, if you're interested in taking a look at it, this is The Impact of Earthquakes on the Central USA, that it was done for FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. If you go to the website of the Mid-America Earthquake Center at the U of I, you can read it. Questions are welcome here, too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Next, we will talk with someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This isn't Urbana. This is Urbana. Yes. My question was: what would a hypothetical earthquake of say 8.5 on the New Madras fault line? What would be the effect here in Urbana?
This is a tough one. Our scenario is based on a 7.7. An 8.5 would mean approximately 30 times the power of destruction.
Well, that's close to what happened in 1812.
Reports vary. There is a recent book that was published last year by Roger Billen from Colorado School of Mines and Susan Huff from USGS that estimate these earthquakes at 7.7 to 7.9. The 7.7 magnitude that we are running is, if you like, the official line of the U.S. Geological mm-hmm. Survey. I know some reports and books say 8.1, 8.5, but it seems that some reports have been exaggerated over the years. I hope it is not an 8.5, and if it happens, I hope that we will not be around. I think that the area of influence that we are seeing now for a magnitude 7.7 would be multiplied by 10 or 20. And hence, unfortunately, even the central Illinois region would be shaken to a very violent level. I hope that this doesn't happen.
And the 7.7 would still yield damage here in Urbana?
It will yield minor damage in Urbana. It will yield other effects in terms of significant loss of services in terms of utility, water, electricity, and gas. Our gas pipelines usually come from the south. Major pipelines owned by CenterPoint Energy, and CenterPoint Energy network is really vulnerable because it passes through the most severely shaken region.
Mm-hmm.
We will have problems in terms of being really overwhelmed by people who are moving from the south and looking for emergency shelter. If it's winter time, there will be significant hardship. We have not, for instance, estimated what would happen to the cell phone tower network. Yet we are trying to collect the information on cell phone towers. We might find that emergency services right now really take into account that they will be able to call each other on cell phones, and this might not be the case. So we will definitely not miss the earthquake. We will feel it very, very strongly in terms of shaking. Minor damage in Urbana and Champaign, but rather severe secondary consequences.
What about some of the soils here? Many of them are a very high water level. Is there danger of liquefaction?
Yes. Liquefaction is a function of two things. It is the duration and the amplitude, if you like, of the shaking. The duration of the shaking in Champaign-Urbana will be long because we are some distance from the fault. The further away you go, the longer the earthquake will be felt for a longer time because it's sort of it is dying out, if you like. But the amplitude or the point from the maximum left shaking to the maximum right shaking will reduce. If for a 7.7, we would expect some liquefaction in our region, but not excessive. Anything above that, in terms of what you said, 8 or 8.5, there will be significant liquefaction. Liquefaction in our region would probably affect the heavier structures that might be tilted or maybe sink a little bit in the ground. But most of our dwellings will not be so much affected.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Champaign County next. This is line
Hi.
Three. Hi.
I think it's going to be pretty grim, but what about St. Louis with the masonry structure buildings without reinforcement? And I'm also wondering about caverns underneath. One can see what happened in southern Illinois in the Shawnee with the massive cracks of huge pieces of rock in some of the formations down there. The intensity. There was a early book from Southern Illinois University Press that I read quite a few years ago that documents what we know about what happened, whether it was 7.7 or not. If a comparable one happened, I've heard somebody dismiss effects in St. Louis, but I'm wondering if that's true or not.
It is. If somebody dismissed damage to St. Louis, then it's not true. There are two things there. There are actually, St. Louis is very much affected by the northeastern segment or part of the New Madrid Fault, and there is damage reported in our study to St. Louis. But also there is a mechanism that affects St. Louis directly. This is the East St. Louis Fault. This is being run now. In our phase two, we have actually confirmed with USGS a scenario, I think it's 6.7 or 6.8, on the East St. Louis Fault. This is very close to St. Louis. St. Louis and Memphis are the two cities that have been selected by FEMA for a detailed phase two study. Remember, this report that was what was just mentioned is actually a phase one study. We are now doing phase two. Phase two does the FEMA regions combined. So, for instance, FEMA region five is Illinois and Indiana together, so that they can plan on pooling expertise and pooling facilities and pooling stockpiles and so on, and also focuses on five city-specific studies. The two major cities are St. Louis and Memphis, so we are now running, for instance, the detailed transportation network model for St. Louis, given every single trip. We have the data, millions of pieces of data that describe every single trip that is taken within a day in St. Louis. Where does it start from? And where does it end? And we are running this through our models to estimate what will happen to the transportation system and also detailed studies of the utility systems. St. Louis is the second worst affected city in the region after Memphis. So whoever is really doubting that St. Louis would be affected should reconsider.
I don't quite understand what the transportation studies amount to. Could you elucidate that a little? I mean,
sure.
You're just saying what would happen to the people that are making those particular trips, or are you talking about the infrastructure?
Yes. What we do in these studies is that the efficiency and the utility of the transportation system is really a major plank in the response effort and also in the evacuation effort.
Oh, I see.
So we are running an actual model for the transportation network to see how will it be affected by the earthquake or different scenario earthquakes, and which areas would be accessible, and which bridges are more critical to the transportation network than others, so that this will be the priority list, if you like, for the Department of Transportation in Missouri to start strengthening bridges so that they protect the network, so that they enable first responders to go in and evacuees to go out.
No lack of building billions of infrastructure improvements. Go ahead. Thanks.
And one more caller here. This is Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes. If I'm redundant, just tell me. But I am curious about the status and if it will happen, the sequestration process that is supposed to be up here in Coles County as a trial, where they bore a hole way down and put the fumes and the sludge from coal into the way down into the earth, and it only go down there by pipe, and under earthquake conditions, have any idea what would happen to that stuff if it would come up again, or what the effects of an earthquake on that operation would be?
This is something that we haven't looked at, but I think it's unlikely to be a negative influence as long as this land is not built over. If it's built over, then there are layers deep down that are much softer than what we expect, and hence there could be large displacements on the ground that affects the facilities. But direct influence, I think, will not be a major problem.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're down to the point here. We have a minute or so left. There's much more that we could talk about. Maybe just as a way of finishing up, you say that this is something that we ought to start preparing for, that we ought to have a plan that we're going to work on over a long period of time. It's not something we're going to be able to do right away. Do you have some thoughts about how you would suggest that governments proceed to begin to try to do the preparation so that if such a thing happened that we could cope with it?
Yes, this is very clear in our minds. We ought to start immediately with emergency services and the essential facilities, energy generation plants, utility networks, hospitals, command and control centers that are really needed to coordinate the effort, transportation systems, so lifelines, meaning gas, electricity, water, sewage, transportation are first priorities to sort out and make sure that we have reasonable service there. The essential facilities, hospitals, prisons, fire stations, and the like. And then in the fullness of time, we start looking at maybe high-capacity residential units. And then at the end of the line, unfortunately, is single-family dwellings and so on. Although it is unpopular to say so, but these are lower priority than things that really impact the community in a massive way.
Yeah. Well, there we will have to finish up. I'm sure that we could talk again as you continue to do the work and look at refining your studies and looking more closely. You know, perhaps we can talk some more. It's certainly an important subject, and I know. Let us say we hope that people in government are listening.
We can but hope.
Our guest is Amir El-Nashai. He is professor of civil engineering at U of I. He's also director of the Mid-America Earthquake Center here at the University of Illinois. And as I mentioned a couple times, if you are interested in taking a look at this report, you can read it by going to their website. So go to MAE, that's for Mid-America Earthquake, mae.uiuc.edu, and you can read it there. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.